Now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Mike S. from Vista.
My name is Mike. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank your speaker coordinator, Sam, for asking me to come down and share it. I want to thank Elise for coming along and friends that came down tonight to be supportive of Alcoholics Anonymous, really. Not so much for me. And I'm super grateful that the deaf have an interpreter. I'll just share real quickly. My sobriety date is June the 1st of 2002. And, you know, it's wonderful to see what's happening in our deaf community that we have ASL at now 11 meetings. And when I was involved in general service, we only had about two or three of them at that time. And I was more newly sober. Obviously, I've been sober now for 17 years, but I went to a meeting called the Fourth Dimension Group, and it was the first time I'd ever seen a deaf interpreter. And I thought, you know, because I was a little self-absorbed, I said, isn't that wonderful they have an interpreter so the deaf members can hear what I have to share, right? And then it flips, and then it switches, and I go, oh, I have an interpreter here so I can hear what it's like to come into Alcoholics Anonymous and not have the luxury that I have that I can hear, but they can hear through sign language, and American Sign Language is its own language. You know, we have meetings that are interpreted for and translated for our Spanish members, you know, and I've had a lot of things happen in my life in sobriety that have just opened my eyes to the beauty of this fellowship, and it's taken away all my prejudices that I came in here with. And so anyway, as I said, I'm an alcoholic. I loved the effect of alcohol. I loved the effect of the other party favors that I had, the marching powder. I loved all that stuff. And, and it wasn't until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and started reading the literature that we have that I came to identify, you know, through the doctor's opinion. I normally don't read anything from the book, and I don't want to try to say it wrong. So I'll tell you what hit me like a ton of bricks when I started reading our big book. It says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effects produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems like the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented until they again experience a sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they've succumbed to the desire again, as many do, then that phenomenon of craving develops. They pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. And they repeat this over and over. That was what it was like for me. I mean, I got into Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 23, you know, and at that time it really was a cry for help for me. I guess I tried to overdose myself with some cocaine and drinking. And got rushed into the hospital, emergency, and went to Mesa Vista. And that wasn't enough for me. You know, that was 5 years before I'd have my first child with another marriage. And I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for a good 10 years, knowing that I was powerless over alcohol. My life was completely unmanageable. And coming up to that, you know, when I was born... is really probably when it started. You know, I was already pushing God away at, you know, the age of four. You know, I mean, I'm the only kid, I think, that ever got expelled from vacation Bible school. You know, and the teachers would call my mom, and there's something very wrong with your son. You know, he's stacking up chairs. He's not letting the teachers come in to teach. And, you know, maybe that was my rebellion there. I needed a drink, you know, for that ease and comfort, probably very young. I know they tried to prescribe Ritalin for me, you know, which was the drug of the 60s. And my parents didn't like the way that I was reacting to Ritalin. So my mom started to take tranquilizers, you know, to deal with me. And I'm sure I was, you know, I'm sure I was a real piece of work. But I really didn't start drinking until, you know, I went to private school. You know, my parents did the best they could. They brought me up in the church. And I was about 17, and I really believe with being an alcoholic, there's that one drink where you could, or that drinking experience that you couldn't feel more one with the world, and it brought everything that was gray, and it made everything, like Clancy says, really technicolor in my life. And then along with, you know, drinking, sex, drugs, it was on. And by the time I got to San Diego State, you know, my grades that I were so good at, and was, you know, very involved in sports when I was in high school, you know, and I was going to San Diego State playing intramural basketball with Tony Gwynn, you know, my freshman year. And, you know, I remember going to one of the guys that was on my intramural basketball team, and we were going to go up to the gym, and he, you know, would have all kinds of party favors out there before we would go play basketball, you know. And then by my second year in college, you could tell that the wheels were starting to come off. The priorities around my education and school and being a good student were completely gone. And, you know, that's when I really started to experience this powerlessness. Man, I could not stop. I could make promises. But I knew that something was very wrong with me because I couldn't. I couldn't put it down. And fast forward a little bit later, you know, I've got a pretty good job. I'm making quite a bit of money. Which is also one of, you know, part of my six-step inventory that I know now, without God's help, you know, I'm going to go back into, you know, if I don't take step three to the core of me, where I'm making a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, I know those things around power, prestige, sex, money is going to be in the forefront for me. And, you know, I was just lost. And, you know, I made a call to a friend of mine who I was working with. And I knew he had a big book. And I went over to Pat's house one night. I was living down in Ocean Beach. And I went over to him and I said, I can't stop drinking for the life of me, man. I can't stop. And he says, well, I want you to do is I want you to pull out a piece of paper and I want you to write down all this terrible shit that's going to happen to you the next time you drink. And I said, okay. You know, I was feeling pretty desperate. I'll do whatever he tells me to do. And I started making a list of all these awful things, maybe a good 20 things on this list. You know, I'm going to lock everybody out. I'm going to lock myself in my apartment. I'm not going to get the mail. I'm definitely not going to call, you know, anybody else. I know what I'm going to feel the next day. All these terrible, this terrible shit that's going to happen to me next time I start drinking. Because once I take one, it's more like I'm going to go to two, and then I'm going to go to 20. And I made this big list. And the way I used to drink is, yeah, I'd get this remorse feeling the next day, but 3 days later, I would be back at the bar again. You know, this whole powerlessness thing. I can tell myself until I'm blue in the face, I'm not going to drink again. All this stuff's going to happen to me. So there I am again, 3 days later, sitting at the bar at Carlos Murphy's, when they had a Carlos Murphy's here down in Ocean Beach. And I knew the bartender pretty well, and I, you know, 3 days later, I've got a shot glass and a beer on the bar, and I'm staring at that stuff, and I've got my list out. I'm staring at all this. As soon as I take this drink, I know this stuff's going to happen because it's happened all the time. And I'm just baffled. I'm staring at the drink. I'm looking at the list. The bartender comes up to me and says, what are you doing? I said, I'm looking at this list of all this terrible shit that's going to happen to me as soon as I drink this. And he said, well, let me see the list. He looked at it there at the bar, started going through all this stuff. And he looked at me and says, it's not that bad. And I needed that because I needed somebody to reaffirm for me. I desperately needed that, you know, because I needed to change the way I felt. Now, I can tell you up to that, you know, all the way up, you know, even before that, I was running around the streets of Imperial Avenue, drinking, using, hopeless to die drunk. I could not stop. And I couldn't even stop after that. You know, having all these great reasons, right? And then, you know, it wasn't until I started getting to meetings up in Escondido, you know, that I heard stuff like, you're either done drinking or you're not done drinking. And if you aren't done drinking, you can't do this program good enough to stay sober. But if you are done drinking, you can't do it bad enough to get drunk. And Alcoholics Anonymous is a great place to get done drinking. It really took the heat off of me. You know, because I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for those 10 years. You know, I started going to meetings in a lot of clubs, and I thought about this because I'm going to a meeting now. I'm the secretary for a meeting up in Escondido that Sam started. And I've outlived 8 Alano clubs up there. That fucking blows my mind that I've lived longer than that movement of that club in Escondido 8 times. You know, and the one of the guys that was an attraction to me about staying sober, because, I mean, let's face it, if you're new in here, and welcome to the newcomers, you know, you go, damn it, my life is over, man. And I'm here to tell you life is just beginning. There's plenty of examples of here that the incredible stuff that happens with the freedom once those that bondage of alcoholism or the bondage of alcohol is away. We still have the ism. And that's the big thing that I heard, too, in that first meeting I went to. I heard somebody say, you know what the difference is between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic? The non-alcoholic, he has some problems. He has a few problems. When he drinks, he stops drinking and the problems go away. But for me, for the alcoholic, I stop drinking and the problems begin. Right? Because if I haven't taken the steps, and I haven't worked on the steps to get a conscious contact with a power greater than myself, if I don't get to know really the core of what makes me tick in the middle steps, and if I haven't gone through the amends around all the stuff that I've done and can see my part in those things and make amends to others, I'm bound to go back to drinking. And that's why we always talk about people that are dry drunks. Plenty of people in AA that all of a sudden they start getting secrets. And that's why I'm so grateful for the fifth tradition. Because when you think about what each group's purpose is, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers, that's tradition five. That tradition to me shows me that why people with 35 years go out and kill themselves. That also shows me why we need the new person here too, and why I need to be here. Because people came up to me and said, if you're grateful you're sober, you will put your ass in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because you never know when God is going to pick you to deliver a message that somebody else needs to hear. And gratitude that we have in this fellowship comes with action. It's not a feeling. I don't feel necessarily good that I'm here. I'm grateful that I'm here, and I'm grateful I get the opportunity because somebody asked me to. But I feel that to my core, that I'm responsible when anyone anywhere reaches out for help. I want the hand of AA to be there, and for that I'm responsible. And whether that's being in general service, whether it's being in service in general, being a greeter, it all is super important. And we're all important in Alcoholics Anonymous, whether you're the newest person here or the oldest person here. Because everybody needs each other. I need the new person just as much as I needed the old timer when I got here. So it's hard for me to say that, that the newcomer is the most important person. Because when I was new, it wasn't the newcomer that was important. It was the guys I saw in a seat every fucking night or day in the same seat. I could count on them being there in the group where I got sober. I could count on them. So it's the newcomers like the blood. Mid-timers, I guess I'm a mid-timer. Is it a mid-timer at 17? Does that sound about right? All right. And then the mid-timers or whatever, were the ligaments, and then the old-timers are the bone, the backbone. And I can't walk through life without all three of them. So the steps have set me free, but the traditions are probably what I really focus on now in my recovery. It's 10, 11, and 12 for me. It's taking that inventory at the end of the day, realizing my part in things, meditating, and carrying the message to someone else. But it's more the traditions that I practice now on a daily basis. And thank God for the whole 36 principles that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the steps keep me from suicide, really. The traditions keep me from homicide. And the concepts keep us from genocide, from AA imploding way after I'm gone. And I think it's the other two parts of our triangle that have impacted me the most, especially in the last 17 years. Because I was sober for 6.5 years. I got sober originally in 1995. I was sober for 6.5 years. Had a daughter. Was married at the time. And with my first spouse, the mother of my daughter, they told her, interesting enough, when I went to my second rehab, they said, she is so much more fucked up than you are. She didn't have a program. As soon as I got sober, she hated my fucking guts. She hated the fact that I was sober. And they said, well, if she doesn't want to get to Al-Anon, your marriage is probably doomed. And I hung on that marriage for about 6 years. Until we called it quits. But it was during that time I wasn't rigorously honest with my sponsor, too, at the time. I mean, I was in AA, wasn't doing the things I'm doing now. But after 6.5 years, all it took was going on a cruise ship. And I went on a cruise ship with 6.5 years of sobriety, feeling really restless, irritable, and discontent, not being rigorously honest with my sponsor. And somebody that I knew for this adventure, it was a work cruise for award ceremony type thing for business. And we're heading out of Tampa Bay, sun setting. I'm feeling just lonely. And one of the guys came up to me with a Mai Tai, and, you know, it looked kind of nice, you know, in the sunlight, I mean, in the sunset. And he looked at me, the guys knew I didn't drink, they didn't know I was an alcoholic, but they knew I didn't drink, my co-workers from the Western United States. And all it took was one of them coming up to me and says, "Mike, we're going into international waters where it won't count. You don't have to pay taxes in international waters. You can gamble, and it won't count. You'll have a sobriety date in the United States. You'll just have a different one in Mexico." And I know, I think it's hilarious, but I needed that at the time. Because, again, drinking is the solution for me. When everything builds up, and I don't have a program, and I'm not, you know, if I'm not being honest, rigorously honest, you know, that's, again, it's a restless, irritable, discontent state. And it brought me to my knees again within 2 days. I was out buying drugs in front of a church in Cozumel. I risked everything, you know, getting back. I could have gotten arrested. But then when I got, you know, I knew I was coming right back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew I was coming back, you know, because I experienced it again, this complete powerlessness and risking everything that I had in my sobriety. And so I came back. Didn't want to tell my friends right away in my home group that I had taken a drink after 6.5 years. And my daughter at that time was 7 years old and a hope-to-be Olympic ice skater. And I was traveling a lot with her. And she had a skating competition back on the East Coast in Boston, in Maryland. And so I announced myself as a newcomer at a meeting in Georgetown in Washington. And it was a time right after 9/11, of course, so everybody was out with machine guns and M16s. It was kind of a crazy time. But, you know, when I made that, announced myself as a newcomer again, I wanted to get this, right away, this contact with this higher power again. And I decided to go to the seventh biggest church in the world, which is the National Cathedral. It's in Washington, D.C., and I went into this big, beautiful Gothic church, and I was walking up to the altar, you know, to have this big, I don't know, this breakthrough, this time of enlightenment, and I got on my knees, and I didn't feel a thing. My next best idea was to go to a meeting of AA after I did that, and so I looked in the meeting schedule, called somebody, I didn't know where anything was, and the next meeting was, like I could find, was in Maryland. And so I got in the rental car and I drove all the way up to Maryland and went into this basement of a church. And I walked in and never felt more love and acceptance in a meeting of AA. And I was the only white person in the room. And it just goes to show me again that AA works. And that all I had to do is close my eyes and listen to the message. It doesn't matter if they're white, black, pink, you know, whatever anybody's background was. I heard the music of AA again. And I've been sober, you know, ever since. I went back, announced to my home group, like it was some big fucking deal for me to announce myself that I drank. And they didn't give a shit. They said, "Oh, we're just glad you're alive, right?" People back in Escondido said, "Yeah, great." You know, it wasn't no big deal, right? And so that set me on a new path in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I remember people saying things like, "In about year six and, but between years five and six, you'll hear a loud popping sound. And if you hear it, that's your head coming out of your ass." And I go, "Well, that's funny. I never heard that when I drank after 6.5 years. And so I started exploring this whole thing about the head popping out of the butt and what that was all about. And then for some reason, I happened to, you know, I got very involved in general service, especially in this area as an area officer for Alcoholics Anonymous as a chairman. And got really involved in AA service because, to me, the more I get involved in past the steps and stay involved in AA and get into the traditions and concepts, the more I get away from self-centeredness. The more I practice and look at the other things in Alcoholics Anonymous that I never did before. And but there was a survey that Alcoholics Anonymous put out that talked about the demographics of AA. And it said in that, and I'm not a numbers guy, but this impacted me. And it said that, you know, in that survey that was done, that in our fellowship, 31% of us have less than 1 year. Almost one out of three is less than 1 year in AA. And then years two to five is 24. They have in our meetings, 24%. But between years 5 and 10, it's 12. And then over 10 years of sobriety is 33%, the majority of our membership. So what that meant to me, because I looked at that, is that made sense. Because I'd look at phone lists all the time in meetings, and you'd see there's a lot of people that have less than a year or 1 year of sobriety, and then it starts to diminish between 2 and 5, but there's this huge vacancy between years 5 and 10. And I go, oh my God, I took a drink after 6.5 years. What's different between what I did then and what I'm doing now? And even though I think for me it was the opposite, I, you know, was going through some changes in my life, and I decided to take a drink because, of course, it didn't count, right? But somebody said, you know, don't let the things that AA gives you take you away from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think a lot of us, I mean, I know for me, you know, as I got sober and cleaned up, you know, I started making money again, you know, maybe I have a relationship, maybe I get some property, you know, and life is going really well. And all of a sudden, I don't need to go to AA like I used to, right? But then again, I had that schooling in AA. It was wonderful with people, for sure, I didn't like when I got there, that became the best mentors for me in Alcoholics Anonymous around the principles of making sure that I come back, making sure I'm here for the next person, you know, making sure that guys like, you know, Gene Castle, I mean, the people that, you know, from Escondido, because they taught me, you know, that gratitude was an action. And somehow I took that in. But I can tell you, even between getting sober for 6.5 years and, you know, even right, you know, when I got sober the first time, you know, God works in, I think, in really bizarre ways. And before I got sober for that first 6.5 years, you know, I was convinced I would never stay sober. I'd already been in and out of AA. I can tell you I had already gone to four places of recovery. I'd been to the Betty Ford Center. I'd been to Mesa Vista. I'd gone to the Sunrise Center, you know, and I'd gone through all these, you know, these things to, you know, get my life turned around. And the day that I got into the McDonald's Center was really what started it off for me. I ended up going to the McDonald's Center, and that gave me the foundation I had for my original first 6.5 years. But the way I got there is pretty funny, because I'm not going to stay sober, and I'm at work, and I'm going to make that call to the person that's going to do the intake for me, and I decided to pray on it. So I went across the street to go get my lunch, and then I was going to pray on this decision to go to the McDonald's Center. And I got my chicken, and on the way out, I saw this huge bag of fortune cookies. And I thought, I'll get some fortune cookies. So I just bought the whole bag. There must have been 200 of them in this big bag. Right? And I get back to my desk, and I'm sitting down there, and I'm contemplating, you know, should I just throw in with Alcoholics Anonymous and McDonald's Center at the time. And so I go, all right, I'll just pull out a cookie and see what it says. I opened it up, and it said, you're on the right path. Follow through. And what did I say? This is bullshit. I'm going to get another one. So I reached in there and grabbed another one. Opened it up, read the message, you're on the right path. Follow through. And then I'm thinking, oh, they all say that. They all say that. So then I reached in again, grabbed another one up, and opened up, and there was nothing in there. It was the first fortune cookie I ever opened where there's no message. It was kind of like to me, I already told you the first two cookies. Why don't you just do, you know, you're on the right path, follow through. So I'm not here to say that God speaks through fortune cookies, but I tell you, that day I think he did. And my life, even though I drank after 6.5 years, and now I've been sober since June the 1st of 2002, you know, the difference for me is I definitely am well into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm well, what's the best way to put it? I'm planted. I know that I have a place here. And I know, you know, that I know what the 12th step means, you know, and the 12th step calls. And, you know, whether it's going to a service event like PRASA, you know, to carry a message to somebody else out of, you know, our area, and the things I've learned in, you know, general service. And how much time do I have? Got a few. I want to share one thing with you that impacted me more than anything. Because I've had a lot of these things happen on the road that have really shown me what Alcoholics Anonymous does. And I'm a big fan of the ocean. I love to surf. I love everything that's related to the ocean. And so I was on a trip to Ixtapa in Mexico. I went to Mexico and Zihuatanejo. And when I got on shore, I saw this picture of this beach. And this beach was beautiful. It was like the only way you could approach the beach was by a Jeep, I was told. And of course, I didn't have a Jeep, so I, you know, the locals there said, you got to approach this beach by, I mean, you got to approach the beach by Jeep. And I said, well, is there an address or anything you get to this beach? He says, no, you're going to go through a village. And so I took his map, I got the Jeep, and I took off through the jungle, literally the jungle in Mexico, to get to where this beach was, because it had waterfalls cascading. It just looked like a beautiful spot. And I made the turn. I could see the beach. I could see the water. And I'm going down this road that was a dirt road. There are chickens crossing the street. There are pigs going this way. There's somebody pushing the cart with the, you know, with the fruit in it. And I can tell I'm approaching this village, you know, very primitive. And I'm still staring at the beach. And all of a sudden, poof, land right in a pothole. You know, that's why they said you got to take a Jeep, because the roads are really primitive where you're going. And the pothole made me turn to look where I was. And right there was this primitive little building where it had aluminum siding, it had a chain link fence, and I see a triangle there. And because I hit the pothole, I got to see this, and I got the Jeep out of the pothole and pulled into this dirt lot. And I got to look inside there, and there's like 5 desks. And there's the steps in Spanish, the steps and traditions in Spanish. There's Bill and Bob. And I'm going, wow, this village, somebody had to start this meeting in this little village that you couldn't find if you knew where it was. And people in this village are getting well. And my first sponsor, Bob, was so big on, you know, always expressing to me the 2 miracles in his life. It wasn't that he was a miracle. It was Alcoholics Anonymous is a miracle. Who else can a drunk stockbroker and a drunk proctologist get together to form this program, you know, through all this other stuff that happened, the people they were influenced by, to start this program? And my first sponsor, Bob, was like, you know, the 2 biggest miracles for him was Alcoholics Anonymous and insulin. Because before him, you know, diabetics a lot of times couldn't survive, right? And so there's been experiences like that that have impacted me enough to know that, I mean, we have, what, 1,500 meetings here in San Diego, in San Diego and North County. We have now 11 meetings for the deaf. And we're so lucky here that I get the opportunity anytime. I mean, I know there's meetings on Adams Avenue at midnight. I know there's a meeting in Coronado that's still at 5:30 in the morning. So I have no excuse to not participate in my own recovery. And as much as I went to go to the endless lengths to drink and use, I really don't have an excuse to not participate in AA. If I want to stay sober and want to stay well, you know, we have to keep coming. And so I think, you know, you know, we get sober here, we get maybe on a pink cloud, you know, and then somewhere around year two or three, maybe stuff starts to become real. And it happened for me too, inviting or asking somebody to come over and help me paint the house, Uncle Dave. And I had him come over to my home. I had an Escondido, and I said, you know, I think I was feeling like my life wasn't going to get any better. So I asked him, is my life going to get any better? And he said, no. I'm sober just like 2 years. And he says, but you'll get better at life. And ain't that the truth, man? Because it's all my perception. It's my perception about stuff. It always has been. You know, what I think is bad for me ends up being good. You know, so I've just stopped labeling and judging the events that happened in my life as good and bad. Because I did make that decision to turn my will and my life over the care of God. And either I did or I didn't. So taking that third step, anytime I'm thinking about anything that I draw in my pea brain, that it's negative, good, bad, any judgment that comes in, I can still hear the people in that first meeting telling me, did you or did you not make a decision? And that has carried me through things that I thought were incredibly challenging for me. You know, because I'm here to say that, you know, not everything has been, I think I can say this in this crowd, not everything is blowjobs and rainbows. Can I say that in this meeting? I already did say it. It's on tape, right? All right. Maybe we had to edit that one. Yeah, we've caught nothing. So, but it's been really good. It's really been good because of the steps of AA. And it's allowed me, you know, that the first few steps are all about my relationship with power greater than myself. Right? Coming to believe that something bigger than me. And if you don't have to have a God conscious, you don't have to even think about the word God here. You can use this group as your higher power. Because that's a power greater than me. Is, you know, having more than, you know, a conversation with a drunk. And was a huge shift for me, because I came in here with all thoughts about religion, you know, what my upbringing was, and I was force-fed the God of my parents' understanding. You know, and I had to get to a spot that was comfortable for me about the God of my own understanding. And it was such a gift that was given to me from somebody that wasn't even in AA. You know, I was up doing a job, again, a newly sober, I don't know, maybe I was sober 4 or 5 years, and I went up to this woman. She had a just really beautiful home. She was an artist. She was a widow. And I was doing work for her. And I just noticed how happy she was. So right away, and I see somebody that's happy. I know the people in AA are happy. Or maybe there's something spiritually connected to this. And I went up and I asked her, I go, you know, where do you go to church? So for some reason, I thought maybe that was what it was about. And she looked at me with soft eyes and she said, oh, Michael, God is too big to be organized. Just blew up this box, you know, that I had about what God was, and it imploded. And after that day, I never had to try to define, you know, what God was for me. I just knew it was something bigger than myself, and I wasn't it. You know, then the middle steps, I know what makes me tick. I know, you know, through a step 6 and a step 7 and doing the inventory, I know what makes me tick. And I know if I get upset about something, it's not you, it's me. And that was huge. I mean, the awareness that somebody that, you know, has done something, probably doesn't even know they did it, number one, but it's something going on with me. And that's where that fear inventory comes in. So I can see, you know, what my part of it, where do I feel threatened? And I've had people in my life that, you know, when I would get upset, what are you afraid of? That's the best thing sponsors have ever done. What are you afraid of? Because I know it is. The Big Book makes it really clear. There's hundreds of forms of fear that I come in here with. And even if I'm sober, if I get upset, it usually is something that's fear-based, almost always. So what am I afraid of if I get angry? And I've also noticed the people that are most angry in Alcoholics Anonymous are always the ones that are the most afraid. So treat them with love. It's not about you. It's not about me if somebody's pissed off. It's them. I'm just being who I am. You know, so the beauty that we come into the AA with, I think it's to thine own self be true. You know? And I can tell you one of the gifts I've gotten with Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is something I love. I love being a football official, you know? And I came into AA, I could be in a room and really be concerned about one person thinking unkindly of me. And, you know, wonder what I had to do to fix that, right? And probably it wasn't anything that they disliked me anyway. And now I get to do something on a football field where freaking nobody likes me. Everybody's pissed off me for one half, and then maybe they may love me the second half, you know, but it's something that I've become a good football official because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't take things personally, you know, so when a coach is screaming in my ear, didn't you see that hold, you know, on the sideline, and really just chirping out a lot of joyful comments, you know, I can pause. AA teaches us to pause. And I can address the coach, and I can say, what did you see? And he can go off and just go off on me, and then I can look at him and say, well, if that's what you saw, then I was wrong. That's not what I saw. I don't have to worry about being right anymore. And my first sponsor, Bob, was so huge with that. He said, love him anyway, honor the people that God puts in your life, and be humble enough to not have to be right. And then also coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, can I be okay like a blade of grass in the meadow? You know, I don't have to be number one anymore. I don't have to be at the bottom. I can just be fine being a blade of the grass in the meadow. Because I used to think, you know, I heard Jerry Seinfeld said, if you weren't number one, you were the first loser, right? If you were second place. And so I can just be one of many in AA. But I can tell you one of the keys for me has been being of service, doing the things, you know, especially when I was new, doing the things that I necessarily didn't want to do. Right? Which was to be social, which was to shake hands, which to get out of myself, to, you know, go up and say hi to a newcomer. And I didn't come in with those skills. I didn't come in here. I always wanted to leave early, come late. And I know sometimes the miracles of AA are just the beginning of the meeting and the after the meeting, going out for coffee afterwards. I've heard some of the coolest things that happen after meetings and before meetings. It's the road trip going with a group to a meeting. So
you got about 5 more minutes.
Okay. So I got 5 minutes. Also, I've got attention deficit disorder, so sometimes I need a lot of help with people reminding me where the hell I am. Everybody still awake? All right. North Pole, you still up? All right. I know I am. I was going to say a joke, but I won't. Did I say a joke? Okay. So anyway, I had a dream. I went to heaven, and in heaven, it's like this huge Costco-like building, like it's where you kind of, it's not a gate, I guess. It's this big warehouse where you first go in to get ready to go to your spot in heaven. But in this big giant warehouse, there's all these clocks on the wall. And I noticed everyone had a name on it. Everybody I knew in AA was on this wall. And I asked St. Peter about all these clocks. And he says, yeah, when every time the clock moves, ticks, it's because that person has a resentment or something's going on, you know, and then they make the amends, it, you know, when they practice forgiveness, it goes backwards, you know, and so I'm looking at all these clocks, you know, and there was Celie's clock over there, and, you know, hers was, you know, going a little bit back and forth, and then there's, you know, Jess's clock, it's kind of moving a little bit more and stuff, and then I look behind me, and there's a clock in the office, like this Ming office, and it's spinning like crazy. And I say, whose clock is that? And he says, well, that's Sam Leone's clock. His moves so fast, we're using his as a fan. All right, that's my joke. I love Sam, so thank you for letting me share.
would like to introduce our secretary, Minou.